person you crossed the meeting, yeah.
Kind of. Okay, hello. It's great to be back here. Today I'm going to be telling you why, well, actually, to be fair, let's just ask a quick question. How many of you have used suspended disk on Linux? Right. And do any of you ever believe that it works? Right, yeah, okay. So, you're all wrong, those of you who put your hands up the second time. The fact that anything ever appeared to work at all is some sort of figment of your imagination, because it's basically impossible as it could have done. Well, okay, there are possible ways it could work, but they're kind of unlikely. So I'm going to go into some of this and why the existing implementation is just broken beyond any form of repair whatsoever, and what we can do about it. So, those of you who have been to presentations by me previously may have picked up something of a running theme where I discuss how I'm not actually anything to do with Linux. I'm just a rogue fruit fly biologist. As of December, I am no longer a fruit fly biologist. So, there will be no references to fruit flies in this presentation. I wasn't planning on mentioning puppies. Kittens may appear at some point, but I make no guarantees. So what is suspended disk and why do you care? Well, some of you probably don't, in which case I recommend going to another talk. Suspended disk is a process where we look at the entire system state of the running system, and then we save that state to disk. And the idea there is that disk is, in theory, reliable, especially when it's not doing anything else. When we reboot the system, we read that state and restore that state into memory, jump back into that state, and then continue executing code where we left off. The main advantage of suspended disk over suspended RAM is that suspended disk consumes basically no power when the system is in the suspended state. You've got everything powered off, whereas with suspended memory, you've still got to maintain the RAM contents, because that's where your state's being stored. The downside is that there's significantly higher latency in resume. While resume from memory will only take a couple of seconds, resuming from disk at the moment in Linux can take up to about a minute, or in some cases, an infinitely long time. infinity tends to be a larger number than two, regardless of what counting system you're using. So, all in all, you can see that suspended disk is a compromise for when you're not convinced that suspended RAM is going to deal with your situation particularly well. And as a result, we've come up with other implementations. So it tends to come up with hybrid solutions where you suspend to RAM for a period of a few hours and then wake the machine up and suspend to disk. Or alternatively, you write out the disk state to disk and then suspend to RAM. And then if the system power does fail, you've still got the ability to resume from disk. But in general, you get the latency benefits of resuming from memory. The downside of that approach is obviously that the suspend is slightly longer because you need to push this state out onto disk. Especially as laptops become increasingly mobile and people start thinking that 1.8-inch hard drives running at 3,600 or so RPM are a really good idea, that can take an appreciable quantity of time. So how does suspended disk work? And this is the Linux implementation. I have not attempted to examine the precise details of the macOS or Windows implementations because I decided that lawsuits are better if they happen to other people. So first of all, we freeze the processes, and we freeze the processes for a fairly straightforward reason. We want to make a copy of the memory state on disk. This becomes harder if processes are still running because they'll do things like change the contents of memory. And having a process alter some memory that you've already saved to disk can be a problem when you then resume that, because the memory state of the process is no longer consistent and everything explodes. So we stop the processes running, and that makes life much easier. We then suspend the devices because when we resume, we want to be able to reprogram the original device state. Now, in theory, we could do this by splitting the suspends into the devices into two phases, one where we save state and one where we actually power down the devices. And to an extent, that's now beginning to happen in Linux, but we've still got cases where we actually suspend devices at this point, which means that we basically power them down. We then make an atomic copy of the memory state. At this point, the devices are quiesced, so ideally, there's nothing doing DMA. Because, again, that would alter memory contents, and that would be really bad. The processors aren't running, so they're not altering memory state, and we can, as a result, do anything we want without risking corrupting memory state. Oh, by the way, if anything I say isn't particularly clear, feel free to just stick your hands up and tell me that I'm inept and that you'd prefer me to actually explain stuff. Or you can use more polite phrasing. Or ruder phrasing. It's up to you. So we now make this atomic copy of memory. And in order to do this in the existing in kernel implementation, first of all, we have to make sure that there's enough space in RAM for us to make a copy of RAM. RAM. Oh. Really, RAM. I know about this stuff. And this is done by, right at the beginning of this, we push stuff out to swap. And we hope that we can free enough pages to ensure that we can make another copy of RAM. And in general, we can. On most people's systems, the majority of the stuff in RAM at any one time are either executable pages, which are backed on disk already by the binary files that you executed, or it's cache data, which you can just regenerate anyway. So we just throw all that away. And you end up with an amount of information in RAM that is half or less of the available space in RAM. So we now copy this RAM into this RAM. We now have a copy. Now that we have a consistent copy of memory, we can go crazy again. So if we want to actually push this out to disk, then obviously we're going to be doing DMA. So at this point, we turn the devices back on. And you could see this on older versions of SenseDisk. This is supposed to be fixed now, but at this point, your hard drive would spin down. At this point, it would spin back up again. And then there'd be loads of disk activity. And then we save stuff out to disk. And that's screwing about with contents of memory, but that's OK now, because we're not going to restore the copy of memory that we're actually running from at this point. Instead, we're saving the static copy of memory. That gets on disk. Then we power down the system. And then there is cake. And then resuming is basically the inverse of this. You freeze the processors so that they don't fiddle with memory again. You read the state off disk into memory. And then you atomically copy this memory back onto the running memory. And then you start executing it again. And you resume devices, you do all of that stuff. And yay, woo, working suspense disk, right? There are issues. Some of these issues are more fundamental than others, but, we'll cover that now. This is how we freeze processors. Does this make sense to anyone? OK, that's good. I'm really reassured. Because if this makes sense to anyone, then please take my job. So we're going to start from the assumption that you do actually want to freeze a process. Because if you don't, again, you're in the wrong talk. And please go and listen to the discussion of C++ coherency models. Right, OK. So here we have a list of typical Linux processes. Can anybody spot the deliberate error in this list of typical Linux processes? Sorry? No. You're close, but not quite there. Nobody? The error here is that there's no running xsize. And everybody knows that every instance of the X windowing system includes an instance of Xi's. Right, so processes in these square bracketed things are kernel threads. They represent things that are handled like processes but belong to the kernel. They're not parts of user space. So the first thing we want to do is decide whether we want to freeze something or not. And that involves looking at whether it's a kernel thread or not. The problem is that some kernel threads are kind of fundamentally important to making stuff work. An example of this would be k-bong hits, because everybody knows that without bong hits, there's no way that Linux works at all. And so we would look at this and say, OK, we're not going to freeze this, because when kernel threads are generated, they get a magic flag that tells you whether or not it's freezable. And we change the default of whether kernel threads are freezable about once every 30 femtoseconds, as far as I can tell. Nobody can decide whether it's a good idea for the default to be freezable or not, which might indicate that we're doing it wrong. So we don't freeze some of these tasks, because otherwise the kernel doesn't work. So for instance, say your swap partition is on a RAID setup. If we froze the RAID thread, then there would be certain issues in saving that to disk. This is an issue that we're going to come back to later. User processes. Right, we want to freeze those, because user processes are arbitrary codes that could be doing anything. We can trust kernel threads to to not screw us up if we don't freeze them, right? No, well, yeah. Please, if suspended disk doesn't work and you've loaded a module that's not shipped as part of the upstream kernel, then, for all you know, you've just managed to screw yourself up very, very badly. We want to freeze our processes, and MISC and other can be frozen. They're kernel threads that do miscellaneous and other stuff. The distinction is very important. And user space ones all want to be stopped. So we freeze the process. And how do we freeze a process? This is actually a two-step thing. First of all, we walk through the entire list of processes, and we set a flag, PF frozen. And that's just a hint to the scheduler. Any process with this flag that passes through the scheduler gets pushed off to one side and taken off the potential run queue. As a result, that task will no longer get any CPU time, and as a result, that task is effectively frozen, which is all kinds of neat. But a lot of processes won't pass through the scheduler because they're not doing anything. And we deal with that in a fairly straightforward way. We send them a fake signal, which forces them through the scheduler, which means that we can push them off the run queue again. There's one slight issue here, and there is one class of process where this doesn't work, and that is a process that is in an uninterruptible sleep. Sending signals to a process in uninterruptible sleep doesn't result in it being interrupted. There's a hint in the name. And a straightforward example of a process in D state might be, I'll get to network manager in a moment. But also, the most common one that people used to see was if you had a process that was doing NFS access and the NFS server's gone away, then the process will sit there and destate until the NFS server comes back, unless you've mounted it with INTR, but trusting people to do that doesn't seem to happen. Yeah?
Could you get the uninterruptible state just to solve the
problem? I believe that there's somebody here who has been working on something like that.
So the patches I've done allow you to
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Microphone. Where's it go? Right, the context here. Martin asked whether it was possible to just get rid of uninterruptible sleep. And, and Willie has been working on something similar to this that he brought up at the lightning talks at the kernel mini-conf earlier, but...
So the patches I've been working on allow you to fatally kill. You can send fatal signals to a process that's in uninterruptible sleep, but that is not going to help this case. We really don't want to send fatal signals to processes just because we're going to sleep.
Well, you say that, but then you also think that we wouldn't want to panic the kernel while going to sleep, and that's a design decision that we've only recently revisited.
Yes, the author of Suspended Disc does have a panic fetish, doesn't he? This would be a great thing to look at in combination with the task killable patch that I've been working on. We should talk about this when I'm not standing in front of a room full of people.
Anyway, so what actually happens if a process is in D state is that, well, first of all, we realize, oh shit, this process didn't stop. Let's try again. No, it's still not stopped. Let's try again. And you keep on trying for up to about 30 seconds or so, and then you decide, oh, fuck this. Thankfully it doesn't panic. I think at one point it did panic, but what happens then is that the system fails to suspend, it resumes, and by this point you've already pushed in your bag, you're already halfway out the door, and your computer's sitting there and about to catch fire. Oh, and you probably trashed the hard drive. Okay, this obviously applies to laptops. If you're carrying your desktop out your door, then if suspended disk has failed, then you've already got other problems. So the solution to this issue so far has been to... Right, by which I mean there isn't a solution. In any case, your process gets frozen, and hooray! We have frozen processes. Which are kind of like baked treats, except not so tasty. Still, does everybody now understand how the freezer works? Badly, correct. Well done. Yes. Okay, what's the distinction between this and halting? When we halt the system, we kill all the processes. So, suspended disk would be a lot easier if we could kill all your processes first. right, okay, when you restart the system, why are the kernel processes, why can't we just stop and restart the kernel process? As I said, some of these are kind of fundamentally important, like the ones that are responsible for getting your data onto disk in the first place, which is what we do after the freezing. But also, they may just be kernel processes, but they do have internal state. And just killing them, we'd need some way of restoring that state, and that becomes very complex. Well, yeah, it'd be kind of nice to not lose things like interrupt counts, or, yeah, bad things happen.
Ken, for the unkillable one, if the system would be a frozen, I mean, what are they going to do? Can't you just grab their RAM out and bundle them?
Right, so we could say, okay, the process is in D state, so let's assume that it's not going to suddenly start running again, because it's blocked. And in the case of the NFS server type situation, yeah, that might be fine, but there are other ways the process can be in D state. If D state is the state the process is in, if it has entered the kernel and not come out again. And while file I/O operations are a common way of doing that, and so D originally standing for disk, if you make, say, an ioctl on a device node, say if you ask your wireless card to scan for available networks, while that's happening, the process is in D state, because it's inside the kernel. And it won't come out of the kernel again until the hardware signals that it's finished. And that could still happen. You could still get an interrupt from your wireless card saying, I've finished scanning. And then this would suddenly wake up and potentially have an opportunity to kill you brutally in your sleep before we freeze it.
Different ways to work around it. You just basically imagine that it's killed again. However, the problem there is there are somewhere in the kernel, and they might call the puller for semaphores or mutexes in the kernel that they could later on the system callbacks deadlock, very likely in the wireless driver. thing.
Right.
One actually holding the block here.
Right, so the issue there is that the fact that the process is in the kernel may mean that the driver that it's interacting with is holding locks, and it might be that when we attempt to suspend that driver, it's going to want to take that lock. And then you have a process that's not going to run, taking a lock, holding a lock, and you've got the kernel waiting for that lock to be released in order to finish suspending. And that's not going to happen because we're not running that process anymore. So you lose. Well, okay, clearly you lose because you're doing this. Can I make a t-shirt of that? I suspect so. What else can go wrong? And it turns out that there are many, 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 many things that can go wrong. So I'm going to go over some of these briefly. Say your swap is on a fused file system. Well, okay, you've already lost, but an example of this is it turns out that some people, when they install Linux, just want to sort of play about with Linux and would prefer not to repartition their disk and so on. So what you can do, and this is kind of fun, is you make a large file on their NTFS file system, and then you mount the NTFS file system with Fuse to get you a read-write NTFS file system. Then you mount that partition, that file, as a loopback ext3 partition, and then that's your file system. And yeah, you've lost, but we can... There are multiple ways people can lose. People can lose by setting themselves on fire and falling out of a plane, and people can lose by things being slightly slow for them. And in general, it's, I think, not necessary to set people on fire and push them out of planes unless they're really, really bad people. So I prefer to avoid that. And right. Your swap might be on a fused file system, and you might want to continue writing to it, except while in the... well, in this case, kernel threads can be flagged as freezable or not freezable. User space processes can't. So we could set something up where we allow user space processes to say, oh, please don't freeze me. And yeah, that'd be really great because we trust user space programs really well. By the way, that's a lie, just in case it wasn't clear. So we don't want to allow user space processes to say, please don't freeze me, because they're going to do stuff that will then corrupt state. USB drivers might be in user space. Again, it would be bad to freeze those in some cases because it might be that you're using some sort of USB infrared interface which your file system is running over. And again, you've lost, but again, the death by Velociraptor versus being pointed and laughed at. Or, right, so say your network manager, Mangler, whatever, your thing that makes your network not work, has decided to ask for a list of wireless networks just before you hit the suspend button. And, well, you sit and you wait, and 30 seconds later, your screensaver reappears, and you've lost. NFS, because stuff might be in D state, and actually, in NFS, I'm happily going to say that without loss of generality, NFS can go wrong. And probably already has. Do those of you with NFS know where your NFS is right now? Which, you can understand at this point that I'm not keen on the freezer. Okay, let me phrase that a little more clearly. The freezer's a stupid idea. Why do we use it? And the answer is because we can't trust the running stuff to not screw with our state. And why do we still have that running stuff? And the answer is that we're using the same kernel that was running the system. Is this necessary? Do we have to do this? And the answer, it turns out, is, well, not really. We could use a different kernel. And this might sound kind of like overkill, but It's already been implemented. It was implemented 5 years ago. We've got kexec. Kexec is a nice, wonderful way for you to do all sorts of really insane stuff. Kexec allows you to load a kernel into memory, and if you want, you can preload it when you're booting the system, and then jump into that kernel. And an example of this, and you might, those of you who are paying attention might be able to draw some analogies between what I'm about to describe in suspensor disk, is the idea that if a system crashes, you no longer necessarily trust that kernel to do anything. So jump into this other kernel that you left earlier, that with luck the first kernel hasn't scribbled over, and then that kernel will be able to take your kernel and memory state and dump that to disk for later analysis. Yeah, right, I'm going to get to that. Now, this is safe, basically. You've jumped into another kernel, and once you're in the other kernel, the first kernel's not running any of its processes anymore. The second kernel is working in its own section of memory. It can scribble at that as much as it wants because we're not saving its state. We're saving the state of the original kernel, but still there, we're just not running it anymore. And that's great, because now we're thinking, right, there's memory here that we can save, and we don't need to worry about freezing all these processes. We can run as many processes as we want, because it doesn't matter if they change memory state. We're not going to save that memory. Now, we, as Ben pointed out, we still need to, we can't just jump into another kernel and then dump the memory state, because then there's no way of just restoring that state because the devices may be in a different configuration. We still need to suspend restore hooks in the kernel. We still need to save driver state so that we can restore driver state so that your devices are working when you resume rather than being in la-la land. But we can, in a pretty straightforward way, use the existing code to do this, call the existing suspend methods, get that state saved, and then jump into another kernel, and then dump the state to disk, and then we've got a state disk file containing... Basically, you do the suspend to RAM except for the actual suspending to RAM. And then you kexec, yeah. Right now, there is still an issue, which is that it's potentially the case that while you're trying to suspend devices to save their state, a user space process will do something that will interact with the state of that device. And a lot of drivers make the assumption that user space will not be running and cannot enter their kernel code while the system's suspending. USB had a particular problem here, which was that if you try to suspend without using the freezer, then any process that touched USB in any way, say X if you have a USB keyboard, it would suspend it, notice that user space had just accessed the keyboard, and think, oh, right, let me wake the keyboard up again. And then you'd go, oh, wait, all my devices, some of my devices aren't suspended, refuse the suspend. These drivers are unfortunately inherently broken because while ACPI suspend to RAM does use the freezer, which is kind of ridiculous, PowerPC suspend to RAM doesn't, nor does APM. Drivers that have made this assumption have always been broken, and as a result, we need to fix them anyway. So saying, oh, well, you need to fix all these drivers, well, fine. Broken drivers need fixing. Yeah, some people don't always necessarily think through the consequences of their designs particularly well. But, right, as a result, okay, you asked specifically about interrupts. One of the things that you do when you're suspending a device is generally to disable the interrupts, so you don't jump back in. Once you're appending DMA, when you're suspending the DMA, when you're suspending that device, you should flush any existing stuff in flight and then just not allow any new IOs to occur.
It's essentially the first time for a little bit of drive, something tried this quite a year ago, stopped processing with incoming requests and wait for an instant flush out, and then effectively it's just an action that the actual firmware is not based on the yourself or whatever. It's not on like that ground, but
it's disconnected, and it's an atomic operation. And every driver should be capable of basically blocking its sources of requests, which is mostly easy for your main data path, for network drivers, a packet in and out, for a block driver blocking your queues. That's pretty trivial, and your parent subsystem often provide tools to do that easily. It gets more nasty when your driver has 30,000 CCFS entry points that result into hitting the hardware. So there are areas there where we probably still have sneaky bugs, even in drivers that have been looked after a couple of times. I think it's really a matter of managing to get this policy down into the head of driver writers and Linus himself. We still have convinced and come up regularly with interesting bone hits about the idea of just setting interrupts and nothing will happen anymore, kind of thing. But we're getting there. Unfortunately, I promised at Current Summit I would actually write to how to do that properly into driver's document that I still haven't done. So I'm a bit to blame there. But
so, yeah. Just so everyone's clear on this, it's all Ben's fault. Right, so yeah, for instance, for block devices, this is pretty straightforward in most cases. You can just, there's already support in the kernel for freezing block devices, and then that just goes in the file system layer, makes sure that any existing writes are flushed, the disk is in a synchronized state, and then any further file I.O. just gets blocked. The process just goes into D state until it's unfrozen. We need to do the equivalent for every other driver. Sorry, do you have a question?
Yeah, this might be a bit naive, but I've understood that it's very difficult, right? Other operating systems seem to do this. Is there a particular reason that that they are able to do it, or aren't they really doing it?
Okay, how do other operating... I don't actually know how other operating systems work, but I suspect that they did not have a... I suspect that they just did it properly to begin with, rather than... This is going to involve a little bit of history, but so the implementation of Linux suspended disk originally appeared around early 2.2 days, and then was forward-ported to 2.4 and integrated, and then forward-ported to 2.6, and... It wasn't until we hit 2.6 that we actually had support for suspending and resuming devices. Until then, suspended disk didn't really, well, okay, suspended disk worked even less well than it does now. And because of this design, there was very, the kernel was never designed as such to support this. Instead, various hacks were used, and it was just layered on top of existing code in an attempt to make things work without having to rewrite every driver, because rewriting every driver is really, really dull. Microsoft have an advantage here, because vendors ship most of the drivers. Microsoft can fix a small number of drivers and then refuse to certify any drivers that don't do this properly. And fine, you install this driver, pop a box saying suspended disk won't work anymore, it's this guy's fault. Since we can't do that, we've just ended up ignoring the problem and hoping that it would magically work. Oh, and Apple have it really easy because they have no drivers. Now, I'm going to go off on something of a tangent here. This is much more a hand-wavy strawman suggestion rather than anything that I'm particularly seriously suggesting. But there's an argument that we're fundamentally thinking about suspended disk in the wrong way. When you suspend a disk, what are you saying as a user? And as a user, you're not saying, I want to jump back into the same kernel state. What you're saying is, I want all my processes to look just like that. And arguably, we could do this by saving application states rather than saving kernel states. And when I say this, I don't mean asking the applications to save themselves. I mean going in there and, without letting the application know what's going on, dumping all its state to disk. There are various implementations of this for Linux. It's a pretty straightforward, reasonable application called CryoPit that was presented here a couple of years ago that does a lot of this. And you dump all your application state to disk, and then you restart all those processes, and everything's fine, right? Well, actually, obviously it's not, because otherwise we'd be doing that. There's a few minor issues, like the fact that X tends to become unhappy if you do this, that processes become unhappy when their PIDs suddenly change, and it's difficult to guarantee that they'll come back with the same PID, and that we'd still need to save hardware state somehow. I'd argue that the hardware state is actually something that would be worthwhile doing anyway. Right.
And some software state, for example, currently mounted file systems. I would want those to also be preserved.
Right. So you need to actually special case for those stuff. And this, well, the network may not be the same when you come back anyway. If processes can't deal with an IP address changing, then I think you need better software. I hope you never use DHCP. But, right, well, got stronger behavioral guarantees there than with IP addresses. Well, okay. Sure. From now on, you can't make any of these semantic assumptions that always used to be true. That would be bad. The way that the libata driver in the kernel handles suspend resume is kind of interesting. Rather than really going into much effort of saving state and restoring state, it treats suspend and resume as a special case of error handling. Something happened to this disk. It's now in a different state to what it was before. Recover it. If we can move to a model where the mid layers kept enough information to allow devices to be reprogrammed, then we could, instead of saying save all your hardware state, we could say reprogram yourself to this mode. Oh, same resuming over different hardware configurations.
That's right, because you might be docked and undocked. So when you resume when you're docked, you might have completely different hardware and different network interfaces, for example.
Well, that's fine. That was not the difficult bit, but
in many cases, it's a matter of properly handling the bus drivers, so drivers that actually drive multiple devices behind them, such as USB, to properly delay the discovery of new things and the removal of old things after the resume. And it will be exactly the same as doing a live undock or a live redock. Of course, if you had a mounted file system on something you just unplugged, well, you chose. But you chose either way if you remove your USB key at the wrong time. So exactly the same. There's nothing fundamentally different there.
You maintain the current kernel behavior of panicking somewhere in the USB. But OK, maybe not. Yeah, it's, as I said, this is really something that's drawn out. I'm not suggesting that this is how we should fix suspended disk, because this would be a huge amount of work. But it would bring other benefits, like the ability to deal with hardware failures much more gracefully. If a network card falls over, then rather than the entire network system going horrifically wrong, if you had support for PCI hot plug, just freeze all requests from applications coming in, pull the card, plug in a new card, and then resume stuff. Because the mid layer would have enough information to save that to restore the network state of the new card. And then you just have applications that broke because the MAC address has changed. But then you can do that anyway, so, well, whatever. That's pretty much everything I wanted to cover. I'd prefer people to concentrate on the earlier stuff rather than this stuff, because this is insanity.
Could I just say, checkpointing applications would also ease the pain for, let's say, physics PhD students who might have like an 8-day long-running simulation, and then the OOM killer kicks in and chooses
there. Right. So I think that, for the most part, the stuff that would need to be done to make this implementable is stuff that would be great to have in the kernel anyway. And if people implement all this stuff, then we could do this. I would not really suggest that we do this in order to get suspended disk, but if it happens, it's a great side effect.
And this also touches on the other operating systems. I'm pretty sure other operating systems do something similar to the KExec. They'll actually have a microkernel or, you know, crash dump drivers doing their disk writing. But interestingly, some other ones also use their bootloader to restore the image.
Right.
Does the KExec approach address that at all?
It doesn't actually need... We can already resume from bootloader in Linux. Intel have some code for this that is really, really scary. There's basically a patch to grub that lets grub pull in, load the kernel, make sure that this saved state correlates to the kernel. Then instead of loading your RAM disk, load the entire contents of RAM and jump into there. Hooray! It scares me. And I'm supposed to look in. Unfortunately, they've written it for grub 1, and so upstream have just summarily refused to look at it because they're all working on grub 2, which I hear will be the definitive bootloader for the herd. And it's possibly expected to be released around the same time. I'm being unfair here. The summary is that the freezer is unreliable and cannot sensibly be made reliable. There are just too many cases where the freezer model can't work, and we can't remove those cases from reality. Designing interfaces that work in reality is, I feel, an underrated way of doing things.
But this is like a twisted version of crash dump, more or less, that you save to your swap instead of saving somewhere else.
Yeah.
So you can probably share a lot with,
well,
with crash
exactly.
dump.
We can share a lot with crash dump. The issue is that we need to save the hardware state as well as the memory state. That's basically the only difference. Oh, and we want to be able to start it again, which is less true of crash dump. Ideally, yes. You
not notified by the interface happened, you just want to know what
they're going to do. Yeah. So this must be reliable, because otherwise, eventually, people will start suing you. I'm not so worried about this, but guys who actually sell Linux, perhaps more so. Therefore, we need to remove the need for the freezer, and I believe that the easiest way of doing this is with KExec, and thankfully, a guy's Intel is working on this. So the future is much more promising, and potentially, in the future, there actually will be cake. Oh, yeah. I'm looking for a job. Right, we've got some time for questions.
Hey, I have a question. But this borders to snapshotting, sort of. So if you go into your little crash dump jail, if you go out of it again, you sort of come back to the to
right,
the state.
So you could argue that this also implements certain types of interesting system snapshotting. The problem there is that you have a snapshot, and potentially later you'll restore that snapshot, but if you've got, say, writable file systems, the underlying content of the file system may have changed, but you've also saved cached data, and so you're now going to have kernel states that doesn't match hardware states.
Unless you snapshot
the file systems as well and then restore those snapshots. And yeah, you could do this, but I'm not convinced there are great reasons for doing this, but if you wanted to, yeah, it would work. So some systems will support file system snapshotting, in which case you can snapshot the file systems, leave them blocked while you snapshot the kernel state, and then restore both of those in one go at some later point, and you have exactly the same system. Apparently BufferFS may be able to do this, in which case it's even greater than I've been told it is. How's this different from saving a virtual machine to disk? The virtual machine has the advantage that, in general, it's not interacting directly with hardware. So we just need to save the emulator's fake hardware states. We don't need to save any normal hardware states. Also, the emulator, when you're saving the virtual machine state, you're doing it from a hypervisor, right? And that can just stop everything inside the virtual machine. Whereas we can't do that in the non-hypervisor situation because we need to do the saving inside the virtual machine. And so it still needs to be running. So the virtual machine case is significantly easier.
But
Right. An alternative approach to this would be to, rather than ever running stuff on the bare metal, would be to run it in a hypervisor situation, and then we could just have the hypervisor save stuff to disk. Problem there is that this will only work as long as all hardware accesses are abstracted through the hypervisor. And that's not just a bit slower, especially if you're trying to do stuff like, say, 3D. And, well, we make suspended disk reliable, but suddenly GLX Gears runs at 3 frames per second.
Let's say you're using a hypervisor like Xen or LVM or any of those things. Most of those don't support 3D gaming, for example. So if you're using it as a desktop environment, it's a lovely idea, but it won't work because you just can't run your games that way.
And anyone who tells me that I need to run a hypervisor in order to have suspended disk works gets stabbed in the face.
But
But suspend the disk, when you suspend, you page out lots of pages, right?
Currently, yeah.
Right.
And
but if you do
that... We only do that in order to free up enough RAM to be able to copy RAM into RAM, because we hate life.
But if you do things with crash dump, you don't really have to do that, right?
Exactly.
So you can jump in and you can do save things in there, which means you have faster boot time, probably, because not so much seeking.
Right. One of the problems with suspend disk is that we throw away a load of your caches and we push a load of your processors out to swap. And so you resume, and it's really slow for ages afterwards because everything needs to be pulled out of disk again. Right, so you have a little script that immediately does that when you resume. You're doing it wrong.
You probably still want to provide to the kegs suspend kernel some information about your cache, because if you have 2 or 3, 4 gigs, which is becoming not uncommon on your laptop of memory, and it's all full with basically read-only cache data that is direct neural things already on the disk, do you really want to spend half a minute writing all of that out into your suspend image?
Right. So in some cases, we may want to throw away anything that hasn't been touched for a sufficiently long period of time.
Yeah. So you might want a little bit of feedback from the VM or access to some inside information about the kernel that you're suspending.
Oh, no, sorry. I think the kegs, that one can just go and read the data structures, right?
Could be. But the really interesting thing is with this approach is that essentially fixing it is the same thing as fixing suspended RAM.
Right. Suspended RAM currently requires the freezer as well on x86, which is horrifically broken. And so fixing that. The only thing really stopping us from having kegsec working reliably at the moment is that we still have the freezer. And we need to get rid of the freezer for suspended RAM to work properly. Everyone's happy. Well, okay, maybe Powell's not. Ben, I'm sure, will be all over this.
I was just going to ask, I think you were in the promo somewhere mentioned that you're going to talk about the different types of suspended disk. Why they're... Is there one any better than another, or are they all... I mean, you seem to imply
there
the whole world is bad.
There are multiple implementations of suspended disk. There's the in-kernel SWSUSP. There's suspend2/tuxonice/tuxoncrystalmetal, whatever. and then there's USWSP. These all work in different ways. Suspend2 is basically the in-kernel stuff with even more madness added, which means that it works faster and it has rotating spheres of madness on your screen while you're suspending. And then there's USWSP, which does everything in user space and then promises really hard that it won't screw up. The problem with all of these is that they all use the freezer. So while there are differences in the implementations, they all have this basic critical failure. And they all absolutely, at a functional design level, require this behavior. So we can't make them good. If I had to use one, I would find a different job. Or I would look very carefully at where my life had gone wrong up until this point. I don't recommend using any of them. I don't recommend anybody deploying products based on any of these. For home usage, I would recommend if you really want to suspend a disk, you don't use Linux. I'm actually serious there. What does Ubuntu use? Ubuntu uses the in-kernel one because that means that we don't have to keep patching the kernel. And then save your Linux state by saving the VM state. Right. It's an option. Or use suspend to RAM, except it actually has the same bugs at the moment, but yeah.
Okay, we've got one more question, and then we're probably going to have to wrap up for now.
Sorry, I just had this a little naive question. As the hardware is developing in solid-state disks and getting faster and faster, with the possibility that solid-state disks could get as fast as RAM, is that going to change the thinking of this completely, or do we have to rewrite it, or is it just a small change, or do we just ignore it completely?
If solid-state stuff gets to the speed of RAM, then I think we would probably just stop using RAM, which makes the spend to RAM a lot easier. If your system RAM's non-volatile, then this is really, really easy.